Beginning in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. This is the Rain Report. I'm Norm Seeley, KI7UP. A number of ham magazines have come and gone over the years. CQ, however, has weathered six decades of turmoil and technological changes in the amateur radio industry, a feat in itself. January 2005 marks the 60th anniversary of the first CQ magazine published way back in 1945. Ironically, U.S. ham radio operators were forbidden to transmit by the FCC at that time due to World War II. So why would anyone launch a risky venture like a ham magazine in the thick of World War II? And who would have the yayas to take that risk? These questions and more were recently answered by the current editor of CQ, Rich Moseson, W2VU. Rain's founder, producer, Hap Holly, KC9RP, spoke with Moseson about CQ's illustrious past.
Well, you actually have to go back farther than 1945. You have to go back before World War II, when there was a magazine published on the West Coast called Radio. That actually was an outgrowth of a magazine called Pacific Wireless News that started in like 1915 or 1918. Radio magazine covered amateur radio as well as what we would 40 years ago have called hi-fi and things like that and audio. And in fact, it became audio magazine after the amateur radio part of it dropped off. During the late 30s and early 40s, they were covering less and less amateur radio news, particularly during World War II, when amateur radio was off the air. In 1944, Sanford Cowan, who was publishing other electronics-related magazines, bought Radio Magazine, primarily with the intention of continuing to publish radio as a broadcast and audio-related magazine. He was prevailed upon by the chairman of the FCC, according to what he told me back in 1994 for our 50th anniversary, to publish a ham radio magazine because the FCC chairman at the time felt it would not be a good thing for QST to be the only amateur radio magazine. The FCC apparently felt that it was important to have an independent amateur radio magazine, even at a point when amateur radio was off the air.
What can you tell me about the first year of publication?
I believe the first issue they printed 10,000 copies and were amazed when they sold all of them. The focus then was the same as the focus now, hams and ham radio. And, you know, our focus has always been on the people side of ham radio, that ham radio is a people hobby, people who are using technology to communicate, to come up with new ideas and designs. But the focus really, in our view, is always on the people. And it's been like that from the beginning.
What was the format like in those days?
Original magazine was a 6-inch by 9-inch magazine. Anyone who's been around magazines in general for more than 40 years will remember the smaller format magazines. Today, almost everything is 8.5 by 11 because of printing economies. It was in that 6x9 format up until 1976 when it became impractical to keep printing at that size, and we went to the 8.5 by 11 format.
Who were some of the notable names in the evolution of CQ?
Too many to list, really. I mean, one of the great things about this magazine has always been the great people associated with it. The first editor was not a ham. His name was John Potts. Sandy Cowan, the first publisher, was not a ham. The person they brought in who really knew ham radio and eventually became editor at some point, he was editor in title for only a few months, but in fact for many years, was Larry LeCashman, W2IOP. Our first DX editor was Herb Becker, W6QD, who had been DX editor at Radio Magazine. He revived the Worked All Zones program, helped develop the CQ Worldwide DX contest. The first running of the CQ Worldwide DX contest was in 1949. The entire year of 1948 was something run called the CQ DX Marathon, which was kind of a year-long activity where the goal was to work as many stations as possible in as many different countries and zones as possible over the course of a full year. That gave way to the CQ Worldwide DX contest, which has the same goal, but over the course of two weekends instead of a full year.
And if I'm not mistaken, that marathon year, there were 190 hams who submitted logs from 22 zones.
That sounds about right.
How many logs do you get today?
3,000 to 4,000 logs in each of the single sideband and CW portions of the CQ Worldwide DX contest. I'm not sure how many zones are accounted for in those logs, but my guess would be all 40 of them or very close to it.
Probably 10 times that many who actually participate but don't send in logs.
That's right.
I know one of the notable personalities involved with CQ was Wayne Green. Tell me about that.
Well, Wayne started out as our radio teletype editor back in the early 1950s, and in 1955 became editor of the magazine. And was editor for 5 years until 1960, when he left to start 73.
Did he begin his infamous columns at CQ while he was editor there, or did they not start until he left and started 73?
I would have to go back and look at some of his editorials when he was editor, but from what I recall, there was nothing along the lines of what he began doing in 73, where he was publisher as well as editor and could do whatever he wanted.
I'm speaking today with Rich Moses of W2VU, the editor of CQ Magazine, and we're talking about CQ's evolution. We'll be right back. This is the RAIN Report.
You're listening to RainReport.com, the only authorized internet source for RAIN audio.
Wayne Green built a career out of bashing, either bashing the league or predicted the demise of amateur radio decades ago. Have there been any real colorful columnists in CQ that have stood out over the years that you're aware of or that you recall?
Well, first of all, let me point out that 73 Magazine is no longer being published, so I'm not sure how far the doomsaying is going to get you, particularly when the facts don't bear it out. We've always had a varied lot of columnists, including Wayne Green. I would say our most colorful columnist today is probably Dave Ingram, K4TWJ, who has a sense of enthusiasm about ham radio in general and his particular love of QRP that is just unmatchable. It's infectious. It carries through in his writing. And it's hard to read one of his columns and not come away excited about something or other.
How has the editorial policy changed?
The editorial policy basically has not changed in the past 60 years. Back in the very first issue, the editor at the time, John Potts, wrote an editorial philosophy. This, then, is the raison d'etre for CQ, a magazine for the radio amateur with a particular invitation to the newcomer. It should not, however, be inferred that we shall confine ourselves to the ABCs of ham radio. We visualize CQ as a magazine that will stick with the ham long after the parts of his first rig are dust-laden in the junk box, and as a monthly refresher course for the old-timer. While placing some emphasis on the elementary, we are still under obligation to carry through with articles on modern techniques and apparatus. Similarly, we shall follow up tradition, with which every ham must be familiar, with all the vital news of amateur radio today and tomorrow. That was the editorial philosophy of CQ Magazine in 1946. It continues to be the editorial philosophy of CQ Magazine in 2005.
What other ham magazines were there in the 50s besides CQ and QST?
Well, I wasn't around then in ham radio, so I can't give you a first-hand answer. There were a lot of smaller magazines that popped up and came and went. In the 50s, those were the primary magazines, QST and CQ. 73 didn't start until 1960. Ham radio didn't start until 1968. I don't recall when World Radio started publication, but I'm pretty sure it wasn't that far back. There were some smaller specialized publications, a couple of VHF-focused magazines in the 50s, and, of course, magazines from other countries, the Radio Society of Great Britain and Radio Amateurs of Australia. They've all had magazines for quite a long time.
When did the magazine go color?
Well, that's also been evolutionary. The cover of the magazine has always had some color on it. It's been basic, was two color for a long time. The inside cover ads were also two colors from the beginning. It was probably in the early 1970s that we went to full color covers, started adding some color on the inside as well. And then that's also been an evolutionary thing. We've added more and more color pages as the technology permitted and as budget permitted. Nowadays, we're almost completely full color. The printing technology is such that you can print color pages for very close to the same cost as a black and white page. So it becomes less of an issue economically to print full color, and it's a much more attractive page in color than black and white.
I know that there are a number of magazines over the years have had these reader response cards.
We had them for many, many years, and in the last few years we've replaced them with survey cards on various issues, and we survey our readers most months on different sets of questions. That basically has been a function of the internet. It was a lengthy process. You would circle a number on the card, mail it back to the magazine publisher. They would collect a whole bunch of them. When they had finished collecting the whole bunch, they would send off the names and addresses to the different manufacturers or dealers whose numbers were circled. At some point, the manufacturer or dealer would send out the information that was requested. It usually took, overall, about 2 months from the time that you circled the card and put it in the mail till the time you got your information. And back when that was the only option, well, it was great. But now you can go to a website and find the information that you're looking for in seconds. The use of those cards dropped off dramatically with the advent of the internet and the World Wide Web.
Just think of that. 2 months, and now it takes literally seconds. That's just an amazing evolution in how fast information is being processed and can be retrieved today. And gosh, all that time it took for somebody to have to collect all these cards and sort them out and get them shipped off to the right manufacturers. And
we, along with a lot of other magazines, use a service to do this in the latter years of it when I was involved with it. Basically, there were people who set up a service that you would send the cards to them, and they would do the sorting and send out the lists to the different manufacturers. So it wasn't being manually done by us. It was being manually done by somebody we were paying to do it.
Whether you did it manually, again, it costs you money.
Yes.
Whether you guys did it or had it outsourced.
You know, it took a tremendous amount of time. Because obviously, they're not going to send a thing off with a 37-cent stamp, or however the postage was at that time, to a manufacturer for every card they receive, you know, or each day's cards. They're going to collect them for a week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks before they send them off.
And probably send them bulk mail.
Yeah. It was not a particularly efficient process.
Rich Moseson, W2VU, editor of CQ Magazine since 1999, speaking with RAIN founder-producer Hap Holly, KC9RP. We'll learn more about CQ's illustrious past, along with the plans for commemorating its 60th birthday, next time. The RAIN Report is copyright 2004. RAIN, all rights reserved. I'm Norm Seeley, KI7UP.